Hey, everyone, this is Steve Donahue with another episode of the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. Today's episode is number 58, and what this is a recording from the message that I preached this Sunday at Mount Tabor Baptist Church on Genesis chapter 6 through 9, the flood. And I had to cover a lot of information there and quite a detailed message, although certainly not one of my better ones, but it is one that covers a lot of information, and so hopefully it should be able to give you a perspective on the environment that we have now as a result of the flood, as well as the way in which God works in his redemption. And so stay tuned for that. But before we actually get into that, I want to make sure that you are following us on all the various ways that you can do that. The best way, of course, to know of all the updates on the website is to follow the website by being a registered member or registered user. You can do that on the right column of the website. Sign up there. It's free, and you'll get email updates as to when new shows come out and any changes that are made to the website. And then also be sure you're following us on all the various social media, YouTube and Twitter and Facebook. And that way you can get all the additional information that we put out there. And also be sure to not only follow us on that, but to share us with your friends so that we can continue to grow the audience. Appreciate you doing that, those of you who are making it known. And then also, if you have any feedback that you'd like to give me, I'd encourage you to provide that. You can do that. The best way to do that is through the email, which is steve@thelegacypodcast.com. You can also provide comments through each of the episodes themselves at the comments section. You have to be a registered user in order to do that, so that's another reason to become a registered user. But nonetheless, you can provide comments there. I would appreciate feedback in any way that you provide it. That way I can help know what shows are most beneficial to you. I can kind of keep track of who's listening to what based upon the amount of downloads for the episodes, but still it'd be nice to know which shows are most beneficial to you, which ones you like, which ones need to be improved, those kinds of things. And so give me some feedback on that at steve@thelegacypodcast.com. And then if you like the show and you want to continue to see it grow and improve, then I would encourage you to support the show by being a Legacy Partner. Our Legacy Partner program is $30 a year or $3 a month. With that, you have access to the Legacy Partner page, which is an exclusive members page only, which provides about $50 worth of value with some more to come. And you are also able to support the show at less than 25 cents an episode. So consider doing that. Become a Legacy Partner. And with that, that concludes the introductory segment. So now let's go ahead and listen to the message from Genesis chapter 6 through 9 on the flood. Genesis chapter 6, continuing through our study of some of the most important passages in the Bible. And we looked, of course, at Genesis 1 and 2 and 3, and we looked at the creation and the fall, and now we get to the flood in Genesis chapter 6 through 9. And there is an idea in our culture that is pervasive, and the idea is that God is such a good God that he would never cause destruction, or that he would never send people to destruction or something like that. It's the idea of universal salvation, that God is so loving that he wouldn't send anybody to hell. And, you know, oftentimes we think that's a great doctrine. We fall into temptations of buying into it. But in reality, what we'll see today is we see both the goodness and the severity of God in Genesis chapter 6. And then it covers a lot of other questions that we sometimes have, and some of the questions that are covered in this, although I cannot go into full detail in answering these questions just because of time limitations. But have you ever wondered what happened to the dinosaurs? SARS? Everybody says I say that funny, so anyway. Have you ever wondered why there's so many fossils in high places? You know, they found fossil fish in the mountains of the Alps and the mountains of Nepal and the mountains of the Rockies. And we wonder why they're up there. Have you ever wondered why there are such huge oil reserves in the Middle East underneath all of that sand? Have you ever wondered to what extent all humans are related? Well, some of these questions are answered by the flood. And we'll see the destructive nature of the flood and all that took place with it, and help us to understand an idea or answer some of the ideas of this. The flood of Noah's day was the most destructive single cataclysmic event in all of history.
We can break down the chapter as follows. The purpose of the flood in chapter 6, 1 through 7. The preserved from the flood in verses 8 through 10. If you've got your bulletin insert, you can skip ahead and start writing this down. The preparations for the flood in chapter 6, 14 through 7, 9. The power of the flood. And then the promise after the flood. And so first of all, let's look at the purpose of the flood. We see this in the first seven verses of chapter 6 and then verses 11 through 13. And in verses 1 through 4, what we have is we have a description of the depravity of Noah's time. And it says that there was this situation where the sons of God took the daughters of men, came into them, and created this unusual, mighty men that were on the land called giants. And if you look into the commentaries here, this is a very debated passage, and it seems to be that there was an idea that the demons possessed humans, and these humans then had unnatural relationships with other human women, and as a result of that, through these demon-powered men, they created this race of giants that was just depraved group of people. And I can't go into a lot of detail of that or reasons why that seems to be the interpretation. But nonetheless, the wickedness of man was great upon the earth at this time. And then in verse 5 it says their wickedness was great. Wickedness and evil here is repeated throughout this passage, talking about how continuous and how extensive this wickedness was. It says every intent of their heart was evil continually. The word intent here carries the idea of a framework. It was every outline of their mind was detailed with evil. That's talking about the depravity of man. And so in verse 6 it says that God was sorry, that he was grieved that he had made man. Now we know that God doesn't make mistakes. And so we know that he is using human language here to give us some understanding as to what he is thinking about this whole situation. Obviously, he knew from the very beginning what was going to take place. He knew that there was going to be this great fall. He knew that there was going to have to be this flood to destroy the world. He knew all this when he created man, when he created him in the first place. And so when he's using this language that he says that he was grieved in his heart, it carries the idea of a human understanding. And it's from our perspective. Now we know in Ephesians chapter 4 verse 30 it says that we can grieve the Holy Spirit of God even today by our actions. And certainly when he looks upon the sin of man and he sees such depravity across the earth, he realizes that it is a situation unlike what he had originally created, and certainly far from what his intentions are. So his solution in verse 7 is that he's going to destroy the whole world and start over. He says, that's it. I'm going to start over with Noah and his family, and from them I'm going to create a new line. Now, of course, we know later on in the Bible, as we read through it, that it didn't get much better after Noah's time. In fact, right after Genesis chapter 9, we see Noah continuing to fall into sin. And so it doesn't get much better, but he decides he's going to start right there and change it. Now, as parents, we are often grieved when our children do something wrong, aren't we? When they do something that we know they shouldn't be doing, maybe it's something destructive to themselves, or maybe it's something contrary to the will of God, it grieves us as parents. Our heart is broken because we say that's not what they should be doing. And that's the same thing as it is with God. And from his perspective, he's looking down upon the earth and he says, why? Why does it have to be that way? His heart is broken, grieved over the results of what was originally his design. So God hates sin and must deal with it. And so he deals with it through the flood. He cannot sit idly by while it takes place. Romans chapter 6 verse 23 says the wages of sin is death. And so he is tangibly giving the consequences to sin upon the people of Noah's day through the flood. So that's the purpose of the flood. And then verses 8 through 10, we see the preserved from the flood. And in verse 8, we see this great contrast. So he talks about all this world of Noah's day and how horrible they are. And then verse 8, it says, but Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And That's the beauty of the whole situation. Even in the depth of man's depravity, God puts out his grace and his mercy upon some. And so we see here that Noah finds grace in the eyes of the Lord. And in verse 9 it says, this is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generation. Now we have to understand this as somewhat hyperbolic speech. No one is perfect. And so he clarifies that by saying perfect in his generations. The idea is that Noah stood out among all the rest of the people of his day. Noah was one man among all the generations where God said, that man is the one I'm going to choose. Now, we could look at that and we could say, well, that means that there's a work-based salvation. I mean, Noah was saved because of his works, right? No. I believe that the reason why Noah stood out was because God had already showed favor to him. So that God's grace was already upon him. And because God's grace was already upon him, he stood out. He was different. He lived his life contrary to the rest of the people around him. And so as a result of that, God says, I'm going to stick with Noah. And I'm going to deliver him. So verse 12. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. But Noah was different. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 6 and 7 says, but without faith it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. By faith Noah, being divinely warned of the things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. And so ultimately, Noah exercised faith because the favor of God was upon him. And through that faith, he was able to be delivered from the destruction that was all around him. Just as God chose the nation of Israel later on through Abraham, so he chooses Noah here to be an instrument of his grace and to be able to be delivered from the destruction that was all about. God preserves whom he chooses through his grace. Ephesians 2, 8, 9 says, for by grace we are saved through faith. And that, not of ourselves, is a gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. And so Noah was gifted by God through his grace to be able to escape the destruction that was there. And then number 3, we see the preparations for the flood. The preparations for the flood. And in verse 14, it says, make yourself an ark of gopher wood, make rooms in the ark, and cover it inside and outside with pitch. Now, ark is a word that really means a box. And as we'll see, the dimensions of the ark is just this really big, long chest-like box. And obviously designed for storage and for the capacity to withstand the storms upon the sea. We don't know exactly what gopher wood was, although it's probably some type of cedar or cypress wood, which is a very hard wood. And it says it's supposed to be compartments in it. Obviously, those are the compartments for the animals. And then it's supposed to be overlaid with pitch as an instrument to keep it from being waterlogged and as a water deterrent. And then verses 15 and 16, it says, and this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. So in other words, to put that into our American understanding, it's 450 feet long. That's a football field and a half. That's the length of this boat. Huge, huge boat. But it's not really shaped like a boat because it's 450 feet long, it's 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. In other words, it's just huge, huge chest with compartments in it. And in verses 17 through 21, he says that they're supposed to bring in all the different animals into the ark and two by two, and supposed to have 7 clean animals and 2 unclean animals of every kind. And of course, that is for procreation after the flood. And the one extra animal of the clean animals was probably for sacrifice and for food later on. And some people have argued, well, it's impossible to put all the animals on the ark. Well, there was probably about 36,000 different species probably represented on the ark, with average size maybe a sheep. And the space of the ark could hold 125,000 sheep. And so you can see that all the animals could easily fit under the ark that was designed by Noah. Now, obviously, elephants and things like that, they could have been taken young. And they didn't have to be full-grown elephants. They could have been smaller elephants, and they could have fit on there. But certainly there is ample evidence to show that the ark is the size that it is to hold all the animals, and it could have. And in verse 22, it says, "And Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did," demonstrating Noah's faith. But I think it's interesting to note here that, you know, there's a lot of understatements in the Bible, and this is one of those understatements. It took him 120 years to build this ark. He built it precisely according to the plans that God had given him. Now, can you imagine? I mean, you know, you've probably seen, you know, episodes of this on, you know, some cartoon, or you've seen, you know, books of it or something like that, read to your children books about Noah's Ark, and you've seen different pictures of it, you know, people. And can you imagine the crowd? I mean, here they are. They've never heard of rain before. They've never heard of floods before because they didn't have that kind of thing. They didn't know of boats because they didn't really need boats. It was a garden. They didn't need. And so here God tells them to build this huge, huge ark because it's going to storm. It takes him 120 years to build it. He spends his whole 120 years building this ark. Everybody around him is probably mocking him, making fun of him, laughing, criticizing, saying, "What are you doing?" Noah's gone crazy. But what does it say about Noah? Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did. You know, in our generation, we have trouble getting to church on Sunday sometimes. Noah, for 120 years, built an ark that no one knew about. No one knew why. Couldn't understand it. And he was faithful. So the ark is loaded up in verses 1 through 9 of chapter 7. All the different animals are on there. God made his way for 8 members of Noah's family and some from every living thing to be preserved through the flood by careful preparation of Noah. Now, there was a study done by a Naval Academy scientist who looked at the dimensions of the ark and built a pretend model made out of the same dimensions that the ark is made out of, and put it through all kinds of tests to see its floatability, its ability to be buoyant even in the most difficult of circumstances. And you know what they found out? They found out that it was incredibly designed to be perfectly buoyant. In fact, there were some studies done that when a wave would come to it, the way that it was designed with its dimensions, when a wave would hit one end of it, it would actually turn it so that it would hit the wave correctly, so that it was not going back and forth like this. You see what that shows us? It shows us that God's plans are always perfect. Now, let's suppose that Noah had said, "Well, you know what? It's kind of an odd-shaped vessel to be floating on the water. I think I want to have one that maybe has a different structure to it. Maybe, you know, I'm going to make one that's kind of a round shape." What would have happened? Probably wouldn't have survived. But you know what we do sometimes? We read in God's Word, He says, "Do this," and we say, "Well, you know, I don't know. That seems kind of weird to do it that way. I think I'm going to do it this way." And then what happens? It fails, right? You see, God's plans are always perfect. And when we follow God's plans, that's when we are preserved. That's when we are protected through the storms. That's when we are able to come out the other side in victory. So we should trust God and His plans. They are always the best. They cannot be proved upon. And then we should also persevere in faith. We see this demonstrated in Noah and how he was able for 120 years to build the ark. And, you know, we have how long in this life? 60, 70, 90, 100 years, whatever it is. We don't know how long we have, but we only have that short period of time. Can't we persevere during that time in faith? Certainly we can. We cannot make our own way of salvation, our own way of doing things God's, the way we think that we should do them rather than God's way. And so then we come to number 4, the power of the flood, verses 10 through chapter 8, verse 12. And it says in verse 11 of chapter 7, it says, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month of the seventh day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened." Now, I think this is a way of describing the turbulent situation of release of all the water that was stored up above the earth and the water that was stored up under the earth. Because not only was there rain for 40 days that created this enormous flood, but there was subterranean water that spurred out from the ground. And there was supposedly this vapor canopy around the earth, much like a greenhouse that kept the earth as kind of one environment prior to the flood. And then when the flood happened, that vapor canopy basically just imploded upon itself and dropped this enormous amount of water. And so you have this water coming from the rains. You have the water coming up through the subterranean water, like geysers and things like that underground. And then you have the water coming down from the canyon. You just have this drenching, this total, complete dropping of water everywhere that causes this flood. And it says the windows of heaven were opened for 40 days and 40 nights, great downpours. Now, I know we haven't had rain in a long time, it seems like. And they're supposed to be calling for some rain showers here coming up, maybe tonight, tomorrow, something like that. And what a blessing that would be if we get some downpours and an inch or two of rain. Can you imagine 40 days of torrential downpours? One time when I lived in Alaska in the fall, we had 40 days of rain, where it rained for 40 days continuous. Now, that doesn't mean that we had 40 days of torrential rain. I mean, it was, you know, drizzle and misty and stuff like that for 40 days in a row. But it seemed like we'd never get out of it. I mean, it seemed like we'd never see the sun again in that 40 days. Well, can you imagine torrential downpours for 40 days? That's what it was like. Now, of course, Noah was closed up on the ark when all this was taking place. Verses 13 through 16, Noah's family and the animals are shut into the ark. It rose high above the earth, it says in verse 7. Or 17. All the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. Now this is a description of a worldwide flood. There's some people that think that Noah's flood was just a localized flood. I don't know how they can read this. Destroying all the earth, destroying everything that lived upon the earth, over all the high heaven, all these things, all the descriptions described here as being a localized flood. I don't know how they can see that when it seems to be so clear that it's a worldwide flood. And so they have all of these over all the high hills were covered. Now, I mentioned earlier how they have found fossils in the Swiss Alps of fish. Well, the Swiss Alps are at 15, 16,000 feet. How in the world did a fish get up there? Well, at one time, the land was much more flat than it is now. And when the waters came upon the earth and lifted up, it says, high above all the hills. And so all the hills were covered by at least 30 feet of water, and fish got buried underneath all that and compaction, and then we had the Alps being formed, and, you know, all this plate tectonics taking place, and a lot of details. Sometime I might do this for a Bible study. I've got all kinds of slides and all kinds of interesting videos of some of this stuff taking place. Well, I don't have videos of the actual things taking place, but videos of showing where some of this stuff took place. And it'd be an interesting thing, but of course I can't do that here in a Sunday morning message. And then 15 cubits upwards, it says in verse 20, is 22 feet above the highest peaks. Verses 20 through 24, it accomplished what it was supposed to accomplish, in that everything upon the earth that was not in the ark, killed, destroyed. Everything destroyed. And then finally, in chapter 8, verses 1 through 4, we see a receding of the water. After he had destroyed everything, after the flood had been accomplished, causes a great wind to come upon the earth, begins to dry out the water that was on it, and it begins to recede. And the ship, the ark, lands in the mountains of Ararat, it says. And the mountains of Ararat, of course, the highest mountain there is about 17,000 feet in altitude. And so way up there. Now, there have been all kinds of sightings of ark-like structures in the ice caps of the mountains of Ararat. We don't know, you know, to what extent those sightings are true or not, but it would be interesting to uncover the ark, wouldn't it? In the mountains of Ararat, actually find it. Verses 7 through 12, then a raven sent out. The raven has a wider range of food than a dove, and so the raven is sent out, and it comes back a couple times, but eventually it goes away, and it goes away before the dove comes back, and the dove comes back a couple times, and then it goes away. And the idea is that Noah's testing to see how dry the ground is. And when he finds out that the land is actually dry enough, that the dove stays away, he realizes things are being replanted and regrowing, and the land is coming back to life. And eventually he is able to come off of the land, or come off of the ark onto the land. And in verses 17 through 19, he's given the command again to be fruitful and to multiply and to fill the earth. Same command that was given to Adam and Eve to perpetuate his line upon the land and to be fruitful. Now we have encountered somewhat of the destructive nature of floods and storms. I mean, even just this last week, right? We had the storm come through that, no rain, of course, associated with it all, but wind being able to come through and knock down the power and keep us out of power for a while. And some of you live along the river here, James River. You can probably tell stories of how the river rose and took out land and fences and gates and, you know, whatever it is as it goes through, and the destructive power of a flood. Can you imagine multiplying that 100-fold, 1,000-fold? I don't know what it would take, but multiplying that extensively all across the globe, these floods taking place. And then when the earth begins to come back to life and the waters begin to recede, and how much power there would be in the rushing of the water down out of those mountain ranges, and how much devastation it would cause. We see the tsunami in Japan, how it came in there, and we can see videos of that on the internet or on the television that come in and just wipe out buildings. Multiply that 100-fold, and you can see the power that was associated with the flood. God has incredible power. Did you know that this very moment, God could say boom and destroy the whole earth? That's the kind of power he has. You know, we look at this flood and we think, man, that was just incredible. That was nothing to God. He basically said, windows open. I don't know what he said, but, you know, he basically said, rain, and it rained. Open up, earth, and the waters opened up and came out. And at this very moment, he could say, destroy it with fire. And the earth would be destroyed with fire. That's the kind of power that God has. It should make us humble in his sight. You know, we become so dependent upon things in this life. We become dependent upon power, and power goes out. Really makes us think about how dependent are we upon that. And it makes us show our own humanity when we see that. Well, how much greater to know that God is able to just at this very moment take our life? It should make us really question our relationship with him. And then number 5, the promise after the flood. We see this in verses 20 through chapter 9, verse 17. In verse 20, Noah offers sacrifices to God. He gets off the ark. He realizes he's been saved. He realizes that God has preserved him through this great devastation. And so he offers sacrifices to God. In verses 20 through 22, God begins to promise him something. He says, never again am I going to curse the ground for man's sake through water. Never again am I going to destroy all living things through a flood. Verse 22, he talks about seasons and cycles continuing. No, it's been hot. And when we think about how hot it is, and 102, 103, 106, I don't know what some of y'all's temperature was up to these last couple of days. I can't wait for wintertime. But then when it gets to be wintertime, what happens? I can't wait for it to get warm again. Well, those are the cycles and the seasons that God has placed in his world now. They weren't there before. But now that he has created this new world after the flood, so to speak, he's created this cycles and structures and seasons and patterns and all this as a result and as a promise to us. And so when it gets hot, we should remember it's God's promises that it's going to get hot in the summertime. When it gets cold, we should remember it's God's promises it's going to get cold in the summertime or in the wintertime. And then verses 1 through 7 of chapter 9, he talks about the relationships being changed. And he says that now there's going to be this fear between the animals and man, because man is no longer just going to eat vegetables, but he's actually going to be able to eat meat. And so there's going to be this fear between the animals, one another. There's going to be predators and prey, and man's going to eat the animals. And so there's relationships change. You know, prior to the flood, they got on board the ark and there was no problem. You know, the lions and tigers didn't want to eat Noah. They just came right on board the ship. But afterwards, he changed the whole nature of these things. So there's now this fear between them. He talks about that. There's going to be a need for a government because it says that there's going to be someone to be able to take the life of another when one takes the life of somebody. And so the nature of man and their relationship to one another changes. And then verses 11 or 8 through 11, he establishes a covenant. And again, he says, never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And in verses 12 through 17, he promises this and gives us a sign that this is going to be the case. And he gives a sign through the rainbow. And he says that when he looks into the rainbow, he will be reminded of his covenant with man, that no longer is he going to destroy the earth with a flood. And he will withhold his hand of judgment and not judge us with the flood any longer. And so when we see the rainbow, I saw a rainbow just the other day, Joanna pointed out, beautiful rainbow, or maybe it was Granny pointed out, it was a beautiful rainbow out there, a big one. And it reminds us of his promise to us. Now, I think it's interesting the wording here when it says that he will look at it and he will remind himself. Now, God doesn't need reminding. I mean, he doesn't forget anything. So how does he need reminding? Well, it's, again, using human language to show that he is going to use that as a means of forcing himself to stay his judgment upon man. Now, we do know in the Scriptures that judgment is coming. In fact, I want to read real quickly from a portion of chapter 3 of 2 Peter. It says, scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? There are people today that you ask them, they say, well, you know, Jesus isn't coming back. It's been too long. For this they willfully forget that by the word of God the heavens were of old and the earth stand now the water and in the water by which the world that then was existed perished, being flooded with water. But the heavens and the earth which are now preserved by the same word are reserved for fire until the day of punishment and or judgment and perdition of ungodly men. But beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years is one day. The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering towards us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. So why is God withholding his hand of judgment right now? So that all of us might come to faith. That those who he has still out there that have not yet come to faith might come to faith first before he brings his judgment. And so we see from this both the destructive judgment of God in annihilating the whole world, but we also see the mercy and the grace of God in staying his hand of judgment until all whom he has called come in. So verse 11, therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and the hastening of the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat? Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. You see, what's going to happen at the end of this day or the end of this age is that the world in which we now know will be destroyed again. But this time not by a flood, but by fire. The refining fire of God. And when that refining fire of God totally annihilates the world that now is, he will create a new heavens and a new earth where righteousness dwells. But for the time, he is withholding his hand of judgment so that you and I might come in. God provides a promise for us, and that is that we can come to him in faith. Just as Noah was able to come to him in faith, Noah was able to be preserved through the ark. He was able to be a man who was able to continue his life as a result of his faith in the Lord. So he enables the same promise for us. And so by conclusion, what are some implications for us? Well, first of all, we should know from this passage of Scripture that God totally and completely changed the environment in which we now live. We cannot get back to the Garden of Eden. The environment in which we live now has been so radically changed. We cannot lay down next to a lion. It wouldn't work. We can't put our hand in the viper's den. It won't work. Those days are gone. One day he'll restore them again. But the truth is, the wind patterns, the cycles on the earth, the water cycles, the rain, the wind cycles, the patterns, all of these things are a result of the change that has taken place. And then number two, the character and the nature of God is displayed to us in the flood. He must judge sin. He provides a way of salvation for his people, and he keeps his promises always. That's what we learn about God. And then number three, the flood illustrates the gospel. Man is sinful and deserves death. We see that in the first part of the flood account. And then God shows favor to whom he chooses to save from that death, Ephesians 2, 8, and 9. God makes a way to be preserved through his destruction. John 14, 6 was to say, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And no man comes to Father except by me. And so just as he provided a way for Noah through the ark, so now he has provided a way for us through Christ. And then there is a new heavens and new earth on the other side. This life is not all there is. There is another life to come that's going to be far more spectacular than this life, totally changed and revised by God. And so my question for you is, are you among those who are going to be preserved? If you're not, make it sure today that you are. And if you are, thank God that you can, without a gratitude, live for him. Just as Noah did all that was upon his command from God to do, so we can do all that God commands us to do in the short time span that we have in serving him. Let us pray.
And with that, this has been Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. What will you do today to build your legacy?